after they would pick out that group and shoot them down, even though they got all of us, we also got 27 of their aircraft up there. So they didn't fare any too well. They sacrificed 27 to 13. So, in other words, we got double theirs of what they got, and that's the only consolation we had. But that's the things that happened that were unfortunate for a whole group to get shot down at that one time.
Your time during the war, would you say it was a positive experience, a negative experience?
Well, I tell you, I was 18 years old when I went in. And whenever you get into something like that, you grew up in a hurry. And that was the main thing that it did. It made you realize really what life is all about and what, you know, a survival thing. And you would fittest, or the survival of the fittest, and you wanted to be the fittest, and it was hard, and I never got hit to mount anything except one day, and that one day they shot out my heated suit, and I got a little piece of plaque right there in my leg. It's hard to see it, but that's where it hit me, and I dug it out with my pocket knife and put a patch on it, and we came home. Up there, it was so cold that if you didn't have a lot of heat on you, you would not bleed much at all. Loss of blood was not a big factor. And that saved a lot of lives because of the cold temperature that you had inside the airplane. See, we had virtually no heat in the airplanes, just heated suits that we wore. And we didn't do that in 1943, whenever I was over there, we didn't even have any heated suits. But when I was back over in 44, we did. They had come out with a heated suit to keep them warm. But the experience that it gave you made you realize, I think, whenever you came back, I guess it made a whole lot better citizen out of you, because you knew that you had to do things to promote your own life and the lives of other people around you. And to me, of course, the best thing I knew to do was build, and I like to build, and so that's what I've done all my life. And I haven't worked much with my hands doing the buildings either. Mostly just my head. It's been it.
Yeah. Are you still active in the military now? Or?
No. I was in the reserves up until 1963. And in 1963, I resigned and got out of the reserves. The reason I did is because they were going to put me on B-52 and Strategic Air Command, and we were flying 16 and 18-hour missions, sometimes 24 hours on those things. And I did not care to do it. I was getting older, and I was ready for a little calmer and cooler and collective life than that.
Yeah.
So that's the reason that I got out.
Were there any comical incidents that happened while you were on the mission?
Yes, they were comical to us. They weren't when we made it through it. But one of the things was we were aborted a mission one day because the pilot kept using overboost on the engines, and he said they were going to blow up soon. He had to turn back, so we turned and came back. And when we did, the navigator said that we were in friendly territory. We could take off those flaps. Those things were real heavy. Of course, they protected us to keep us from get hit. The shell hit the flak suit where it didn't, normally it didn't kill you. So anyway, we took our flak suits off. And just after we got them off, here comes the flak coming up from three guns down below. The reason we know it's three guns was because the tail gunner, Russell Thrift, said, "Tail to Bombardier, they're taking pictures of us down here. I wonder what kind of town this is. And what happened was, there were the flat guns going off, and he was seeing the blast coming out of the muzzle of the gun. Well, they came up and they almost shot us down. They put about 20 holes in the airplane, but none of them were life-threatening, and the pilot dived the airplane down, and I had been requesting to drop the bombs, and he wouldn't let me. And finally, when after they shot at us, why, he said, "You drop the bombs when you want to." And I said, "There was a railroad track right down below us." So what I did was, I just picked out, told him to level the aircraft off, and he leveled it off, and I took the bomb sight, engaged it, hit it down the railroad track, and dropped the bombs down that railroad track. But the last one, we came up on a town. I was dropping them about every 300 to 500 feet. Just boom, 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 boom as we went down with the switch. And so the last one landed in this little town. And we got back to the base, and the colonel of the base, Colonel Hilton Butch, said, "What did you do with those bombs?" And I said, "I dropped them on a railroad track, sir." And he said, "That's a likely story." And I happened to remember I had a camera aboard that day. So I went over to the photo lab and asked them if they had processed the film. And they said, "Yeah, they're in the drying room right now." So they were, I waited on them about 5 or 6 minutes, and they handed them to me out of the dryer room. And they were, ours were 8x4 film. And that's the picture that they had them on. And I took them back over and laid them down on the table. Number one, number two, they were numbered. Number one, two, three, four, five, six, seven. And it showed the bombs going down the railroad track. And the last one hitting in the town. And so I called the colonel and asked him to come over. And he came over and looked at them, and he didn't say a word. He just chewed that cigar and turned around and walked back up to the head of the briefing room. And so we didn't know where we had bombed, but we knew he had bombed it. And he wanted to know from the navigator where we were, what town we bombed. And the navigator said, "I'll let you know, Colonel." He never could let him know because he didn't know where we were. And that night on the radio, Axis Sally came on every night, and we used to listen to her, and she'd tell you all about what we did. Whether we were, so many American bombers went down that day, and this, that, and the other. So that day she came out with, that night, she came out with a lone B-17 bomber, bombed the defenseless little town of Limburg. And so I said, I laughed and said, "Well, I never did like Limburg cheese anyway." So that was it.
Well, what did you think about Hitler and what he was trying to do at the end of the war?
Well, I thought he was crazy. Just outright plain crazy. He did some things that were really good for the German people, but he did all these other things that were so terrible. Like, he killed off most of the German youth. I don't see how they had any population left. I guess they wouldn't if they hadn't migrated in from all those other countries that Germany controlled during the war. But that's it.
Well, what are you doing now as far as?
I'm retired.
Retired from the military?
No, I'm just retired from my business. I was in the construction business from 1960 to 1990. And now I'm retired.
Are there any Air Force organizations that you're a member of now?
Yes, I'm a member of the 8th Air Force Historical Society and a member of the 8th Air Force Heritage Association. The Historical Society is where we have a meeting once a year, and all of the groups get together at that meeting and have their separate things, and we see people that we flew with all those years ago. The Heritage Center is, and we're just building it. We're spending $13 million right now on two large buildings One of them is 92,000 square feet, and the other one is 143,000 square feet. And they're going to house the aircraft that we flew during World War II, the P-51, the P-47, the P-38, and fighters, and the B-17, and the B-24, the B-26, and the B-25, and bombers. And we have most of those aircraft. And we're going to put them in for a museum so that your children or your grandchildren can look and see these, what old aircraft looked like and what we fought with during the war.
Well, where is this museum located?
It's Pooler, Georgia, right outside of Savannah. We formed in Savannah in 1942. And then we went back there and tried to get the city of Savannah, but they didn't have any place for us. So we went outside of town on I-95, right at the intersection of I-95 and US 80, and we bought this property and started the museum. We're going to have everybody's name that was in the 8th Air Force. There's 28,000 of us. And we're going to have everybody's name and the stations that they were at, like I was 152 station and 493rd Bomb Group, 863rd Squadrons, and so forth. And they're going to be on plaques at the different locations all around in the rooms. The meeting room's going to be off to the side. We're going to have a big open thing in the center where we're going to have a B-17 and a B-24, a B-25 and a B-26. Then the fighter aircraft are going to be around in the perimeter next to the rooms that we have for meetings. Mm-hmm. And these different meeting rooms for each group are going to accommodate about 300 people.
When do you expect this
meeting
to open?
Well, we've already poured concrete and already have the building going up. And I'll be down there in May. And I was on the board of the 8th Air Force whenever we did all this about the Heritage Center. But my last year was my last year, so I am off. But I'm still going down to the opening. We're going to have an opening ceremony of the first building on May the 12th and the 13th.
Yeah,
well, it'll be open later for the public. And we're not going to have a charge for going through it. It's going to be some of the generals and some of the other people that did real well in business, some of the sergeants and this, that, and the other. I know you see one, old Andy Rooney on 60 Minutes. He was a sergeant, and he has donated about $25,000 to that thing. Such people as Beard over in Birmingham have donated $10,000 and all that sort of thing. So you've got a big influx of money, and that's what's going. We're going to take that money and run the thing and let people come in and walk through it and see what there is there. Well, the only thing, Angie, that I'd like to do is invite everyone. My children I know are going to go, and invite everyone else to go by and see the aircrafts and the oxygen mask. We'll have a man dressed in uniform. When we started in 1942, late 42, right on up until the time that we finished. And these uniforms are different uniforms because we started out with nothing but fur-lined boots and fur-lined pants and fur-lined jackets. We ended up with heated suits, and then we wore Mackinaws and things over those suits that kept us warm. And actually, we stayed warm in 1944, the latter part of 44 and 45. We stayed warm unless you short-circuited for some reason the suit and so forth. But in 1942 and 43, early there, for most all of 43, we like to froze to death. It would be 40 below zero, and we couldn't get above 20,000 feet because it was so cold. But then at the end of the war, while we were flying at 31,000 feet, and it'd be 67 to 70 below zero. So that was the, those were the improvements made. They also made improvements in the aircraft, of course. Different engines. We had an altogether different engine on the last planes from what we had on the first ones. They were much more powerful. We had better superchargers and everything. So if anybody wants to see how the progress or the progression of the war and the war facilities from 1942 to 1945, they should come down and really look that thing over.